All right, real quick, two questions I have here that are pretty much similar. One question is, Mr. Mariner, do you think that price and wage controls by the government are a good idea? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. Because like I said several times, price and wage controls, or any kind of economic control, is a control over ethical decisions of people. And prices and wages, basically prices and wages are the two sides of the same coin. Prices and wages is what helps the economy reward the good entrepreneurs and the good workers, and also separate the bad entrepreneurs and bad workers from good entrepreneurs and good workers. And that means that we increase the value, increase the level and the quality of service in the economy when the government gets involved. We got the government controlling the good entrepreneurs, punishing them and the good workers, and rewarding bad workers and bad entrepreneurs. Mr. Mironov, what do you think of patents? That's a two-side question. One question is, what do I think of somebody stealing the papers from somebody else's office where the guy has developed some kind of a new innovation? I think that's sin, that's civil crime that needs to be punished by the government. If somebody stole papers, it can be proven that he stole papers from somebody else's office, because that's one way of looking at it. Do I think that if two guys independently of each other, when it's obvious, when it can be proven, have developed an innovation, do I believe that the guy who first got to the patent office and filed the patent is the guy who has the exclusive right on making money on that innovation? No, absolutely not. I believe that in that form, patents are basically building a monopoly, and very often, as it has been proven in the last 100 years, very often it is not the innovator that actually profits from the patent, but it's some kind of an attorney or a lawyer or somebody else. And Henry Ford had that problem in the very beginning, because some kind of an attorney had a patent on building a car with an internal combustion engine. What he did is he ignored that, and he built his cars anyway. And when that other, I forgot the name of the attorney, but when he took him to court, Henry Ford's defense was, well, let this guy build his car and let's see if it works. And when they built the car, it didn't work. So that's how Henry Ford won. And it's a true case. So that's how we have the cars that everybody can afford today. So this is the situation there. I don't believe the first guy that gets to the patent offices is entitled to be the monopolist in the field. But if somebody steals papers from somebody else's office, he's got to be punished. Thank you.
The question is, could you give some practical advice on finding and creating opportunities to evangelize, being bold for the gospel, and finding the right thing to say? Of course, 2 minutes is not enough time to answer this question fully. I give you 3 ideas, and I'll illustrate them. The first is, I think you have to love somebody in order to evangelize them. It's like a young lad and a young lass who are in love. And do you have to script their conversation? Love finds a way to express what's in the heart. For evangelism, if you love a person, and if you see and learn that person's needs and identity, the words will come at the right time in the right way. Leads me to the second point. I think names are very important. I'm going to illustrate that in a minute. Knowing a person's name, calling them by name, talking with them by name. And thirdly, never underestimate the power of personal, private prayer with people as an evangelistic tool. Here's my story. I'm in a restaurant, bunch of theologians. They all have ties. I don't. We have a waitress who goes around the table taking orders. She's got tattoos from fingertip to shoulder on both arms. And I mean, these guys, these friends of mine are going like, you know, whoa. She came around, she took all the orders. I noticed her name was Megan. I said, Megan, tell me the story of your tattoos. And she immediately opened up and began telling about how this tattoo represented the time her daughter was born, this tattoo the time she got married. Can you figure that one out? The next tattoo was child number two, et cetera, et cetera. And by the time she was done, I had her life story. Had I had the opportunity, I would have sat down and prayed with Megan. She was delighted to have told her story. That's an example. When you go to restaurants, call your waitress, your server by name. And if opportunity arises, have them sit down and tell you a little bit of their story and then pray and get on with life.
That's wonderful. Okay. This was actually given to Dr. Kelsterman, but he gave it to me. He's a very generous man. You just saw that, right? Can you describe what sustainable agriculture is? I don't see how modern farming is sustainable. The whole concept of sustainability in the environmental movement is very difficult to pin down. There are whole long essays that have been published on the fact that there just isn't a good definition of what is meant by sustainability. You would think that there would be a pretty common sense idea of it, but when you really start probing, it gets very difficult. In the sense that an activity is something that can be carried on over a long period of time, without a degrading of those resources necessary for its enactment, modern farming, industrial agriculture, is sustainable in that you're constantly replacing the nutrients in the soil and so on. You're just not doing it in the way that people would think of as natural, but you're bringing in new nutrients. One thing that a lot of people have the impression of is that modern farming results in a depletion of topsoil and so on. It's just simply not the case. When you check the data with the U.S. Soil Conservation Service, decade after decade after decade, higher percentages of U.S. cropland qualify for the prime rating than did before. This has been going on continuously. You might think about the fact that farmers, after all, have the greatest incentive to take care of their farmland or of their livestock. It's their livelihood, and they want to sustain that livelihood through a long period, just as you have an incentive to take care of your home. So the impression that modern farming is not sustainable, I think, is built upon some basic misunderstandings of how it works. It doesn't mean that nobody farms foolishly. Some people do. But the fact that it's high-tech, that it involves the use of man-made fertilizers, man-made pesticides, things like that, that doesn't make it unsustainable.
A couple of you asked me what the name of the work was at the very end, and I should have told you if I didn't. It's called What Sweeter Music, and it's written by John Rutter. John Rutter wrote the music, but he's setting a poem by Robert Herrick, who lived in the 1500s, called What Sweeter Music. So the poem was very old, and the music was 20th century. But let me ask another question. It'll take a little longer. You said earlier that a piece of art could be composed well but performed badly or vice versa, and therefore good composition and good performance are mutually exclusive. However, if the two are mutually exclusive, it is impossible to have something that is both well composed and well performed, which I don't hold with. Do you agree? Right. When I said mutually exclusive, I mean that they're simply separated from each other. So one of them could be good or bad when the other one is good or bad. It can be both good, it could be both bad, it could be one is bad and the other is good. I'm just trying to make the evaluations on the individual three aspects of good separately, so that just because you don't like the content of a piece, you don't necessarily overlook the beauty of the composition of it. Or just because you like the performance of a piece doesn't mean that it's necessarily well composed. Or just because you think it's well composed doesn't mean necessarily that it has a good bit of content. You see? All of them could be good or bad or anything in between. So separate them out from each other, but don't pit them against each other. It's not so much so that if it's well performed, it has to be badly composed. That doesn't make any sense, right? So, and vice versa. You with me about this? Does it make sense? Go like this, or go like this. Yes, you see? Okay, I want to make sure I'm making sense. Thank you.
Can I add just a bit to that? I actually am of the conviction that very, very well-executed art, whether it's visual art or music or whatever, very well-executed art that is that conveys a false or an evil message is far more dangerous than poorly executed art that conveys a false or evil message, because it's incredibly seductive.
Mr. Mironov, in what ways can we, as Christians, avoid paying taxes, revolt, cheat, protest? Now, we got two extremes here, and one extreme is we got to always pay everything, even volunteer to pay, even when we're not forced to pay, and so on. That's one end of the spectrum. And we have the other end of the spectrum. No, we shouldn't pay anything. Let's revolt. Let's, get our guns and fight, and so on. My position is the position of Paul in his time. Nobody here would say that Paul actually legitimized the social order of the Roman Empire, right? He did use his Roman citizenship at least twice in Acts, and we know that he did at least in one epistle talked about return a slave to his slave owner. We're talking about Philemon and his name, his slave Onesimus. But what Paul did is lay the foundations. If in his time he couldn't deal with all the social evils he had around him, he did lay the foundation for it. So we need to be wise here. We need to understand that there are levels that beyond which we're putting our lives and the lives of our families in danger, and it's an unnecessary danger if we try to revolt before it's the time. Now, I'm not the person that says that Christians should never revolt. In fact, going back in history, I see generation after generation after generation of Reformed Christians who did revolt. Okay? And we're here today, and we're relatively free and prosperous today because somebody in the past revolted. But we need to wait for God's time. Until that time, we will have to pay taxes sometimes. We will need to have to submit to Caesar. We will need to be crucified on the cross every now and then. Meanwhile, we're building the foundation for future generations to actually defeat the beast. That's what we need to do. So, at some point, if you have a personal, or if you have an individual way to really avoid paying certain taxes, I'd say go for it. But if that places you and your family in a danger that is not really a danger that is conducive to spreading the gospel and building that future foundation for the future Christian civilization, I'd say no, pay your taxes. So we gotta be really, really wise, like serpents in this regard.
The question here is: how does a Christian show the world the death of sin without coming across as aggressive? This was one of the last points I made in my presentation this morning. Let me suggest two things on this. How does a Christian show the world the depth of sin without coming across as aggressive? I hear a lot of talk about how the law drives us to Christ, and the law helps us understand the depth of sin, and the law teaches us the heinousness and the wickedness of sin. I believe that's a half-truth. The third truth is the gospelized law does that. I don't mean to identify them, I don't mean to confuse them, but to tell you, in the Scriptures, always the context of the law is in the context of God's favor, His beneficence, His smile, as it were, His gift, His goodness. In the Old Testament to Israel, the law is always contextualized with grace. So if you wish to expose the depth of sin in the world, make sure you're doing it in a gracious, using the law graciously, and not barely, B-A-R-E-L-Y, without grace. That's number one. Number two, I believe the answer is humility, that we exercise solidarity with those in sin. And we do that because we understand sin. Do you understand why a woman would kill her child not yet born? Now, I don't understand this by experience. I can understand it by analogy in terms of the desperation, the hopelessness, and the apparent insolubility of the dilemma that a woman faces. Do you understand why someone would resort to perverted, disoriented sexuality for the sake of communion? For the sake of a relationship? I don't approve it, I don't like it, I don't practice it. I understand sin because I understand my own heart, and that leads me to be humble. Humble in talking to people about the nature of sin, their own sin as well as mine, as we together go to the cross. I hope that's helpful.
I think it's great. I want to first just add a tiny bit to what I said a minute ago. I also believe that it's very dangerous to embody truth and goodness in ugliness. That is, to use wonderful lyrics in lousy music, or to use, to put a wonderful message on a painting or something like that, that is just sloppy, lazy, poor art, Because what happens is that it then sort of deadens the senses of those who see or hear that, and it can turn them off to the truth or the goodness of the content. Since I don't have another question of my own here until one that Dr. Hodges has passed on to me, I'll leave it at that, and I'll do that the next time.
That's a great point. I'd like to kind of continue on that vein a little bit, too. I was reading a theologian, a Roman Catholic theologian called Hans von Balthasar one time, and one of the things he said I thought that was so helpful was that in taking truth, goodness, and beauty, if you take beauty out of that, whatever that is, troika, triumvirate, whatever you call that, Trinity, if you take beauty out of it, it's not that you immediately lose truth and goodness, but he argued that truth and goodness lose something of their appeal. That is, the way he put it poetically is that truth will go clattering on, syllogisms will go clattering on, he says, like machines, churning out conclusions, but those conclusions won't compel anybody anymore. And it's a sort of infleshing of the truth in beauty, combining the two of them together properly, that brings life, I think, to the teaching that you're doing. I tried, for example, to do that in my lectures. I hoped that I was doing that in the lectures. Making a truth statement, but then also making it in such a way that it's embodied in a human condition or a human experience or something, so that you're hearing the truth embodied. I had a girl ask me one time, we were in an education conference, what would all this you talk about music is great, but how would we go about applying this to an elementary school music program? And I thought, oh gosh, I don't know anything about elementary school music programs, but it occurred to me, I know, let's say we were teaching, for example, about Ephesians 5 and about marriage. So we're teaching husbands and wives relate in certain ways, and they reflect the nature of God and so on, Christ in the church. And then, after you've taught that very clear and distinct and somewhat mysterious doctrine, You teach them how to waltz. Can you see why? Because when you waltz, one person leads and the other follows. You can't both lead. You can't both follow. Right? And when you do, one person leads and the other follows, and you learn how to do that. Each person learns his part. You don't get two dances. You just get one. You see? The waltz itself, when done properly, is like one person dancing. It's not two people. You see? So what I thought would put it into rhythm, put it into the physical body, make them actually experience what that means, and they will understand the truth in terms of its beauty personified, kind of beauty in flesh. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Now this is a rather long question. Both sides are written, so I need to split it in two. Maybe need a little bit more time. Now the first part. Even though I didn't ask the question earlier about homeschooling, I wanted to comment on it. I come from the... Who would that be? Tail end? Tail end of a large homeschooling family, and my mom is rather burnt out with teaching. I honestly have to beg her to correct my lessons so I won't get behind. Do you really think... Now, notice this question, and this question tells me a lot about the person who writes it. So I'll be psychologizing a little bit here, even though I don't like to psychologize, but here I will have to. Do you really think homeschooling is the best in all situations, since in this one there isn't that individual focus you talk about? First of all, let me tell you this. I'm not a big psychologist, but I can tell you that this was not written by a teenager. So this was written by an adult person, and two things tell me that it was written by an adult person. First of all, I have yet to meet a Christian teenager who would speak about their parents in such a way, openly and so freely. I know my kids don't. You know, I know that I've never met a Christian teenager homeschool that speaks about his parents in this way. So I'd rather suggest that this was written by an adult person in this audience, or maybe they're not here now, but. Okay, the other thing that makes me believe that this was written by an adult person is the question, do you really think? For those of us that are that have been on, in the public arena and questions, had questions shot at us many times, we know that the question, after you said that you are, that you have a specific position, after you said that you have a specific position on a specific issue, the question, do you really support that position? We know that it's a manipulative question. That is a manipulative question, because that is not a question that gives you any logical argumentation. That is a question that is trying to create doubt in you. Okay? So here I'm teaching you how to deal with these questions. A question like this, do you really think that homeschooling is the best in all situations? I will answer. I always answer those questions. I always meet the bluff and say, yes, I really think, and I don't care about what personal individual situations are you trying to make up to tell me that I shouldn't really think that. Okay. Now, let's only suppose that that's a true situation, that really the mom is burned out and he's, you know, and whoever that is honestly has to beg her to correct his lesson so he won't get behind, and so on. Well, how big is your family? Because I know families of 14 and 16 kids in the family, and they all homeschool, and the mom's dealing with it pretty good. Okay? So obviously there is a different issue there. And maybe the issue is that you're waiting for your mom to do it. But if you're mature enough to write a question like this, you should be mature enough to not leave your mom in the first place to do that. I mean, come on. You have the maturity to write a question like this, and you need to wait for your mom and always, you know, you need her to help you all the time. My kids don't need that all the time. Okay? The other thing is to go, okay, so now I'm moving to the other question, I'm sorry. To go along with that, do you think it would be wrong to send a junior or senior high again? Do you really think a junior or senior high school student to public school as a ministry opportunity? Oh, there it is again, ministry opportunity. I would send my kindergarten child there, but once people reach a certain level of maturity, isn't it our duty to reach out? Those public schoolers will never change if we don't reach out. And since, whether you like it or not, keep this in mind. I will never send my kindergarten child. So this is an adult person who is pretending to be, okay? Those public schoolers will never change if we don't reach out, and since, whether you like it or not, teenagers look up to teenagers. That is not true, by the way. So if kids could reach out to public schools while still living at home, they have a healthy balance because their own parents are there to coach them along. If you have a child and you're planning on sending them to a public school as a ministry opportunity, what I suggest is keep your child at home and go to the public school yourself.
Well, okay, here's a question. When should an alien resident pull out of his surroundings? You remember now, the alien resident is the whole concept we've been working with this week in terms of pilgrims among pagans, and it's our mode of living in the world, not being of the world. Does there come a time when really we do have to retreat, back off, back away, and abstain? And the answer is yes. When? Boy, that's a hard question to answer. When your soul is in jeopardy, when your relationships are imperiled, when your walk with the Lord is jeopardized. Okay? Those are very general, very non-specific answers. But now let me tell you very quickly about what I call the abstinence ethic. The abstinence ethic. And that's this. There comes a time in the Christian community when we have to consolidate our resources. I'm going to use an example of Christian education. Homeschool education. Christian day school education, and we don't have the funds, we don't have the money to mount, that is, to begin a Christian theater troupe, a Christian movie company, perhaps even a Christian daily newspaper, all of them good, desirable, informative, culturally expressive, but because, not because they're bad, but because of an abstinence ethic, we consolidate and devote resources to this aspect of the Christian communal testimony, and we forego the rest. There's a legend of a girl in the Middle Ages who was a beautiful dancer. And there came a time in her life when she realized that dancing was taking over her heart, and so she tied a chain between her ankles and no longer danced. When asked, "Why did you do that?" her answer was, "So that someday I may dance well." That's the abstinence ethic. You have to determine that in the context of the Christian community before the face of God in the light of His Word.
Wow, I wish I had such wisdom. My goodness. This is kind of cool, having so few questions that were actually given to me this time. I get to comment on other people's things quickly. My own philosophy about public education is this. The Eighth Commandment is not, "Thou shalt not steal unless thou art the government." And I consider public education, that is, state-paid education, to be a form of legalized theft. Again, I recommend read Frederick Bastiat's little book, The Law, which is all about the perversion of law to justify systematic theft. And I consider public education to be exactly that. So I would not, out of conscience, send my kids to the public schools at all. Neither would I be a teacher in public schools, because the payment that I am receiving is payment that was taken by government. Now, sure, taxing is a legitimate thing, but education is not a legitimate role of government. Okay, now, Mr. Hodges, do you think that God is always glorified by the love between a Christian man and woman? My answer, not his, is yes. I do think that God is always glorified by the love between a Christian man and woman. Then the question goes on. even if that love is distracting the two from devoting time to Christ? And my answer is, that's not possible. Not love. The one verse in the Bible that defines love, not describes it, but defines it. It's described in 1 Corinthians 13, it's exemplified in many places, but the one verse that defines it, that is, love is the subject, then you have a copulative verb, a form of the verb to be, and then you have a substantive predicate, is Romans 13:10. Love is the fulfillment of the law. Pleroma tou nanou heagape. Love is the fulfillment of the law. I am only loving my wife when I am fulfilling God's law toward her. I am loving her no more than I'm fulfilling God's law toward her. And as long as we're doing that, we're always glorifying God. And, by the way, I would go back to the first part of the question. Do you think that God is always glorified by the love between a Christian man and woman? Yes. And I also think that God is glorified by the love between a non-Christian man and woman. That is, the image of God in us has not been so totally erased that unbelievers are not capable of ever doing what God requires of them toward each other. Now, they never do it to the glory of God. And so, of course, they always fall short. But, hey, don't the rest of us also always fall short? I mean, how many of us can raise the hand and say, yep, I love perfectly? You know? Oh, sorry, we're regenerate and we can't claim that. So, love always glorifies God, whether it's between Christians or between non-Christians. And true love never distracts from devotion to Christ. But that doesn't mean that true Christians cannot see their love perverted so as to distract each other from devotion to Christ. And when that happens, that doesn't glorify God, but then it's not love either.
So glad I gave you that question. That was great, great answer. I have two that are similar about cathedrals, about medieval architecture. It says, what is your opinion of building cathedrals today? First of all, would it be possible? And secondly, would it be in line with Protestant thinking? And then the other one is, you said medieval architecture reflected their faith. Could the complete absence of symbolism in our architecture reveal the emptiness and pragmatism of our souls? I think that would be a bit of a harsh interpretation to say that it only emphasizes emptiness and pragmatism. I think there are other reasons, and some intentional that are maybe good ones. You know, one of the reasons that the Protestants stripped down so many churches in the 17th century, 16th century and 17th century, is that the symbolism and the iconography and so on of the Roman Church had gotten so encrusted that it had actually obliterated or gotten in the way of the truth of the gospel and the Luther's attempt to get back to the solas, to understand the faith in terms of faith, you know, salvation by faith alone. So some things got in their way. Now, I think perhaps there was, you could make an argument that there was an overreaction on the part of some Protestants to statues and paintings and so on. I think some of that maybe went too far. But their intention sometimes was also a good thing, and that is to keep away some things that were distracting people and reminding them of stuff that that had taken the church in the wrong direction. So I'd hate to just dismiss modern architecture and say that it shows only an emptiness of our souls. We're creatures of history. We inherit what we inherit. The problem is we don't ask questions about why it is the way it is. When we do ask those questions, I think we then feel some freedom to create architecture and art and so on that we, in a way that we might not have otherwise if we hadn't asked the questions. The first one speaks specifically of building cathedrals today. It's important to know, first of all, what a cathedral was. Exactly. The cathedra is the word for chair. cathedra is a chair, and so it's the place, the cathedral is the building where the chair, the bishop, sits, and so it's the center point of that particular diocese or area of church, you see. So the bishop oversees the entire area, so he has to have a pretty special place. We don't always think in that sort of hierarchy anymore. Maybe, I mean, there's all sorts of Christian discussion about piety, what am I looking for, not polity in the church. But the idea of a cathedral specifically in most Protestant circles is a little silly. We don't think that way exactly. However, that doesn't mean that we shouldn't build great cathedrals to the glory of God, or cathedrals but churches to the glory of God. So we say it's possible to think in spiritual terms and in artistic terms about what we believe and place those things back carefully, thoughtfully, back into our churches as they are needed. I appreciated one of the fellows today speaking about remembering some of the calendar, some of the liturgical calendar, some of the other dates of the year that we might want to celebrate when we remember the entire gospel and the whole history of the New Testament, Old and New Testament. Instead of just celebrating Christmas and Easter, maybe we want to celebrate Ascension Sunday, for example. That was a significant event, right? And so on. You get the idea. I won't go into all that. But anyway, there are some aspects of the old ways of doing things, the traditional ways of doing things, that are actually very good. Chesterton said at one point that tradition is a good word. Traditionalism is a bad word, a bad thing. To be traditional is to have the living faith of the dead. But traditionalism is the dead faith of the living. That makes sense? Isn't that a great idea? To have the living faith of the dead means that we still have the faith of those who have gone before us. The living faith of those who have already died. We carry that on. We're standing on the shoulders of giants. So tradition could be a very good thing, to remember the real faith of living those who went before us. But traditionalism is the idea that we've always done it this way, and so without thinking about it, in a sort of dead faith way, I'm going to continue to do this and that and the other thing that way, even though I have not really considered any aspect of it at all. So it's possible for me to have dead faith and insist that you take it on. Well, that doesn't make any sense, does it? So let's find out what living faith looks like and how it might be embodied, enfleshed, incarnated. I think I can use that word with a small I, and you'll see what I mean. How do you take what you believe and put it into practice in such a way that it can be passed on to the next generation? I know I'm kind of running along here, but I'll tell you one more thing. That is that's the way we pass the faith on. We speak it to one another, right? We take the word and we preach it to our children. We remember it to our children. But we also take them to church. And if one generation decides, we don't want to have anything to do with tradition, that's bad. See, anything that's gone on in the past is bad. Well, that's fine. Now, we create our own songs, we create our own liturgies, we create our own way to worship, and we're alive, we in this generation are alive as Christians, and that's all well and good until we have children. And then we want to pass what we believe on to our children, and we find that the embodiment of our faith is very tepid, very lukewarm. It's very, that's the wrong word, lukewarm. Thin gruel. It doesn't give you a whole lot of profundity. You have to actually go know and reattach yourself to Bach and Brahms and people like that who have had deep insights and then build on those. You see? So knowing your history, that's why Mnemosyne is such an important person in Greek mythology. Remember the past, and then I think you can pass on something more strong to your children.
This is a very good question here, and it was given to me at the very beginning, and for some reason I ignored it. But I need to answer it now. So, Mr. Mariner, the thriving economies of Germany and Japan are largely due to the help from the U.S. after World War II. Do you think that most of the economic growth is due to the transferred work ethic and religion, the massive reconstruction and investment in their economies, or both? Now, my position is, it is largely due to the transferred work ethic or to the imitated work ethic. Now, we cannot really look at the economies of Germany and Japan and say this much is due to work ethic that they imitated from the Christian from the Christian United States or nominally Christian United States at the time, and so much is due to investments and so on. But we can see how the same amount of investments in other places that didn't imitate the Christian work ethics, what they created in other places. And of course, the favorite place where you can go is, my favorite place is either Africa or South America. Okay? Now let's look at Africa. Now, between 1970 and 2008, Sub-Saharan Africa, north of the Republic of South Africa, receives close to 80 billion British pounds of aid. 80 billion British pounds of aid. That is thousands of times more than what Germany and Japan received as help from the United States. Thousands of times more. Okay, as direct aid. We're talking about direct aid. We're not talking about investment that later on draws value back to pay those who paid them. We're talking about aid given to them, just given to them, with no requirement of payment back. What did it create in Africa? Do we see thriving economies? But in that Africa, there is a small nation that received a very small portion of it. And in the last 10 years, that nation is thriving, is actually coming out of its poverty, Zambia. What's different between Zambia and the rest of the African continent? Zambia is the only nation that in the last 10 years, they changed their constitution and included the name of Jesus Christ in that constitution. That is a nation that is very specifically going, desiring. And I've read articles by their journalists, people there in Zambia, who defend the idea that we are a Christian nation, there's nothing wrong with it, and in fact, this is what's helping us. And this is the nation that got the least amount of all these 80 billion British pounds. Okay? So, obviously, no amount of foreign aid, whether to Germany or to Japan or to Africa, can actually create something. Thus, logically, I'm forced to conclude that the economic prosperity of Germany and Japan after World War II is entirely due to the imitated Christian work ethic. And if there was any effect by the investments and the aid that they got from the United States, it was very small and insignificant.
This question is quite challenging. I'm going to revise it a bit, but first I'll read it. How should we as Christians balance our faith with politics? How are we to balance loving others while still standing up for truth and justice? How are we as Christians to balance our faith in politics? My simple answer is listen to Rush Limbaugh and vote for Ron Paul. But that's also my stupid answer. How many Christians in our country haven't followed the dictates for their political opinions of people like Rush Limbaugh and Ron Paul? Now, I'm not criticizing them as non-Christian, as all this kind of stuff. I'm just saying Jesus Christ, as far as I know, was neither Democrat nor Republican. And I think we need to remember that as Christians, which isn't to say he's agnostic and he's uninterested and irrelevant for politics. It means that the style of Jesus Christ transcends partisanship and transcends what, frankly, are not very redemptive platforms and policies of either or both parties. So I'm not telling you who to vote for. But rather than balance these things, may I choose a different verb and suggest this to you? This verb, the verb I choose is integrate. Integrate. How can we integrate faith in politics? How can we integrate love with truth and justice? And there's so many ways I could answer this question, but let me say this. I think you need to First of all, be immersed in the Bible. I really do believe you need to be immersed in the Old Testament and study the Old Testament and study the structures of the Old Testament, the laws and the statutes and the ordinances of God that He gave to Israel. But I think you also need to study politics and know what politics entails. Politics is the art of compromise. How far does that go? Compromise ought not to be a dirty word if and as long as we recognize that there are situations that call us to prioritize principles. Prioritize principles is not a bad thing. I wish I had time to lecture on this. I could give you a lecture about the need for a situational component in our moral decision making. And that's where Christian politicians often run stuck. I'm not giving you a full, comprehensive, perhaps not even a coherent answer, but I think, number one, you go into politics armed with the Scriptures, armed with the truth of God's Word, and then you seek to employ that with love, with tact, and humility in a political situation that you are thoroughly, thoroughly acquainted with. My concern is that we tend to go for sound bites on the other side. We don't like them, so we choose their sound bites, and they're no better. They're no better as guiding stars for us. That's just a caution.
Okay, what attention should a faithful steward give towards the improvement of the land? I would put it a little bit differently. What attention should the faithful steward give toward the improvement of whatever it is that God has put into his power, that God has given him authority over? Some of us have land. Some of us have relationships. All of us have relationships. Some of us have brilliant intellects. Some of us have great athletic bodies. Some of us, all these different gifts. Our attention should be the kind of attention that returns that gift to God multiplied over. That's the essential lesson of the parable of the talents. If we bury that gift, if we leave it in the ground, we have not pleased the Lord. Now, I assume that probably this question was asked more in the sense of, what's the general responsibility of Christians toward improving the earth, the natural environment, natural habitats? And my answer to that is, for most Christians, probably not much. And I say that despite the fact that I lead a nonprofit whose mission is to glorify God by enhancing the fruitfulness, the beauty, and the safety of His earth, as well as to promote economic development for the poor and the proclamation and defense of the gospel of Christ. Nonetheless, the body of Christ is made up of many members. We're not all called to do the same thing. And much as I'm very passionate about what I do, I don't expect that a lot of you would necessarily share the same passion, and that's perfectly fine. The body of Christ is made up of many members, and I, for one, am really grateful that John Hodges here has brought a different passion into this conference from the one that I brought. It's really needed. I would just remind you also of what Romans 14:4 says. Excuse me, I've got to be able to read it here. Who are you to pass judgment on the servant of another? It is before his own master that he stands or falls, and he will be held up, for the Lord is able to make him stand. I think a lot of us have a tendency to get very judgmental because somebody else isn't on the same bandwagon that we are. God hasn't called us all to be on the same bandwagon. And we're not in a position to judge somebody else for the calling that he has in his life. I stand before my judge, and I'm responsible for fulfilling my calling and returning the 5 talents he's given to me doubled to 10 or tripled to 15. But I'm not responsible for judging my fellow Christian for not doing the same thing that I do.
Can you suggest some less well-known pieces to listen to? I can give you a list if you want. You want to write down some? Okay. let's just go through history. How about a little Renaissance music? There's a wonderful mass by Palestrina called the Pope Marcellus Mass. It was the mass he wrote, sort of counter-reformation mass that's beautiful. So, Mass for Pope Marcellus. That's a beautiful work. William Byrd has written some wonderful Renaissance choral pieces, a cappella choral pieces. So take a look at Byrd. Early Reformation music is wonderful too. There are some composers that Bach knew and loved that are not very well, not very often played. A fellow called Buxtehude, for example. B-U-X-T-E-H-U-D-E, Buxtehude. And he wrote some marvelous works. Heinrich Schütz, S-C-H-U-T-Z-E, with an umlaut over the U. Heinrich Schütz, a pre-Bach Reformation composer. Brilliant, brilliant motets. Listen to his choral music. It's fantastic. And remember that this is early Reformation music. This is what the Reformation sang early on. There's a glorious amount of instrumental music in the Baroque period that you can't possibly get the end of. Vivaldi's Four Seasons, for example, is a wonderful series of violin concertos to listen to. Some orchestral things by Bach that I love are the Brandenburg Concertos. Brandenburg Concertos, he wrote six of those, and they're all delightful. What they call Concerto Grosso. In the classical period, Haydn, I'm learning more and more about Haydn's symphonies. Haydn wrote 104 symphonies, and some they are just marvelous, magical works. Listen to 104 in particular is a good one I did not too long ago. Mozart's symphonies, Mozart's piano concertos. Listen to the number 24 piano concerto in C minor. It's a fantastic piece of music, deep, profound piece of music. I could go on and on. Schubert's songs. I'm trying to get as wide a variety of things as you can think of, vocal and instrumental music. Schubert wrote 600 songs plus, and set texts to all sorts of great romantic and late classical poets like Goethe and Schiller and people like that, and wonderful songs. Mendelssohn's music, instrumental music to A Midsummer Night's Dream. Delightful, absolutely delightful. It's where the famous wedding march comes from. It's the wedding of the Duke and Hippolyta. What can I give you in the 20th century? Listen to Prokofiev's First Symphony. I mentioned the classical symphony. Listen to that. It's delightful. What am I thinking of? Debussy. Debussy's Afternoon of a Faun, Prelude to Afternoon of a Faun. It's a wonderful, glorious piece. And if you listen to that and look at Monet's paintings, you'll see that they're exactly the same thing. Monet and Renoir and Pizarro and some of the famous impressionists were thinking the same sorts of thoughts that Debussy was thinking and so on. Listen to his music. You heard some John Rutter. There's some other works of his that are good. I kind of go up and down with Rutter. I think the one we played a little earlier is very pretty. I think in the 20th century there's all sorts of... Hey, I know. Arvo Pärt. Have you heard of Arvo Pärt? P-A with an umlaut R-T. Arvo Pärt. He's still alive. He's an Estonian composer, Christian, and he has written some glorious choral music. There's a marvelous symphony by a fellow called Henryk Gorecki, G-O-R-E-C-K-I, Polish composer, who died not too many years ago. Look at his Third Symphony. A lot of young people love that work. It's a great work. I'll give you one last thing. Do you know Eric Whitaker? Have you heard of that name? Eric Whitaker has written some interesting choral things lately. One in particular is called... Lux, what is it? L-U-X, not Eterna. I'm sorry, it's gone out of my head. Eric Whitaker, Lux something. I'm sorry, my brain just went off. I jumped from Renaissance to the 20th century pretty quick, but that gives you a little list.
Lux Eterna, what's up? All right. We went a little bit longer than usual, but I think it was well worth it. Let's give a good round of applause for our panel.